You're listening to Women's Media Center Live with Robin Morgan.
Welcome to Women's Media Center Live. I'm Robin Morgan. And we have, as journalists say, a full lid for you today. We have the last of the poems, the mini readings from Poetry Month, that's in Fighting Words. And we have Surrealism Corner, of course. And we have news, not only, as I promised you last week, the Mueller report, but other news, hello, in the world. And my guest this week is a writer whose work I have loved dearly for a long time, Cherie Moraga. So all that's coming up, and first, we need to go inside the headlines. Yes, I've read the entire Mueller report. And no, we're not going to deal with it here in the news section. We're going to deal with it in the Surrealism Corner because whole vast parts of it are totally worthy of the word surreal. For now, for here, we're going to start with a quick revisiting of the still happening category and also the connect the dots category. So, for example, because Americans have awfully short memories, and that's fostered by our education system. In Flint, Michigan, people are still, since the 2014 water crisis, unable to drink trustable water. Still happening. Connect the dots. Most of Flint, Michigan is black. Still happening. Parts of Puerto Rico still lack electrical power since the 2017 Hurricane Maria. This is a double connect the dots because there are many Americans, including the troglodyte in the White House, who don't understand that Puerto Ricans are, in fact, Americans, and that dot should kind of be connected. And also, Hurricane Maria is a product of climate change, which was not linked in people's minds by any of the reporting. Still happening, approximately 1,400 kids are still separated at the border from frantic mothers who fled with the kids from hatchet murders in, for example, Honduras. Still happening. Still happening, religious fanatics are still on the move more than ever. Nice Christian pale male vigilantes at the border who were taking it upon themselves to arrest and detain people seeking asylum. And Islamist militants in Sri Lanka committing murder, followed then by Christian militants seeking revenge against the Muslim community in Sri Lanka. It's really special. That's just a sampling for today, and we'll move on, but we'll return regularly to the still happening and connect the dots categories. The heartbeat bills could ban almost all abortions. They're really aimed at Roe v. Wade. Now, what are the heartbeat bills? Well, Ohio became the sixth state to pass a heartbeat law earlier this month. It bans abortion as early as 6 weeks into the pregnancy, when, I might add, most women don't yet even know for sure that they're pregnant. The other states which have passed or are in the process of passing such bills are North Dakota, Arkansas, Georgia, Iowa, Kentucky. Mississippi has a similar bill. Most of these states have court challenges from the reproductive rights people, thank goodness. But and in Georgia, it's just waiting for the governor's signature. But Ohio now is the sixth state. And it's interesting because the rise of heartbeat bills this year is a sign of where the abortion debate has come. A few years ago, you may remember that such bans were considered way too far out, too extreme, even by the most militant anti-abortion groups. But with Trump in the White House and Kavanaugh on the court, abortion opponents are really all around the country eager to pass these state laws, whether or not they will be challenged. They hope they'll be challenged in court because they're aiming at Roe in the Supreme Court. In international news, we've got many items, but we're going to have to choose just two today. Saudi Arabia temporarily and provisionally, those are literally the words used, have released three of the women's rights activists and bloggers from prison, Eman al-Nafjan, Aziza al-Youssef, and Rukaya al-Mohreb, have to return to court to stand trial throughout this month and probably into early May, along with 11 other women who still are detained and never were released at all. The women have suffered torture and sexual abuse over a year in detention. They never were sentenced, just detained. They are charged with such, quote, criminal acts, close quote, as contact with foreign media, diplomats, and human rights groups. And, of course, the major competitor with Saudi Arabia for supremacy in the region, Iran, is not budging on its sentence of 38 years and 148 lashes for Nasrin Sotoudeh, 55, women's rights activist and human rights lawyer. Costa Rica. At first it was one, and then it was four women who came forward within 48 hours in February, all of them alleging that former, actually twice, president and Nobel Peace Prize laureate Oscar Arias Sanchez, 78, committed sexual offenses on them, ranging from harassment to straight-out assault. Then charges were filed by Alexandra Arke von Herold, a psychiatrist and a anti-nuclear activist. And she was followed by Jasmine Morales, a former Miss Costa Rica, after three lawyers turned down Morales' case because Arias still wields a lot of power and influence in the country. Nevertheless, as of this month, April, at least nine women have joined in the allegations, including a college professor, a journalist, a book editor, and a human rights activist. Feminists are demonstrating daily at Arias's offices, carrying signs reading, "We believe the women." And no disposition has been made yet of the case. We believe the women, too. We have to take a short break here, but never fear. Still coming up is my conversation with the writer and activist Sheree Moraga and Fighting Words. And when we return, the very next segment, the Surrealism Corner. Stick with us. Don't go away. Subscribe to this program on your favorite podcast platform and leave us a review. Follow us on Twitter at WMC Live. Like our Facebook page at facebook.com/WMC Live and visit us at WMCLive.com for more information about our show and our guests.
You're listening to Women's Media Center Live with Robin Morgan.
Welcome back, and welcome into the Surrealism Corner. The United States of America is not even 300 years old, and that's a baby country when compared, for example, to China, Egypt, and other parts of the Americas, which can count the ages of their civilizations in millennia. So we U.S.ers don't even have that long that we need to remember, especially considering how hard some scholars are working to unearth those flourishing civilizations with populations equal to that of Europe's, who were just doing fine when the Europeans arrived in the so-called New World and wiped them out, at least wiped out those they couldn't colonize. Still, we have collective amnesia. Apparently, we can't even accurately work our way back to 40 years or 45. But those ignorant of history are doomed to repeat it. So, the Mueller Report is, in fact, a blueprint, and it makes fascinating reading. And you know I'm a news junkie, but You should read it. It confirms what we knew. It adds juicy details. Don't overlook the footnotes. And it clarifies whether Trump is merely crazy or merely from hell. He's both. The man who, when he learned of Mueller's appointment, slumped in his chair and said, "Oh my God, this is terrible. This is the end of my presidency. I'm effed." Close quote. That man knows exactly what's going on and what he himself is doing, and he's quite consistent with who he's been all his life, which is a sadistic sociopath, exactly like his father. In addition, he suffers from, or rather we suffer from his, growing dementia. It's a super combination. So while pundits hype over Democrats in Congress at war, supposedly, with each other, over whether to leave it for the elections or impeach this very second, the what are we waiting for crowd, I will weigh in with a word for both and instead of either or. Why? Well, that brings us back to history and to 45 years and to Nixon. Nixon barely squeaked out his first presidential victory, but he was reelected by 66.0% of the vote, winning every single state in a landslide except for Massachusetts in 1972. Now, this was after the Watergate break-in that August and after the 1971 revelations in the Pentagon Papers. The cover-up began to surface very slowly through March and April 1973, but it finally broke big time with the televised hearings in May of that year. Public opinion then began to shift, and then it gained more momentum with each day of the hearings. Even so, over 30% of the public remained Nixon loyalists. Nixon, in turn, disobeyed subpoenas, and 1973 was also the year of the court battle over the tapes. But by 1974, the House Judiciary Committee decided that they'd played the role of educator of the public long enough, and now it was time to lead. And it was. The timing was excellent. The committee brought impeachment charges in July of 1974 on grounds of obstruction of justice, abuse of power, and contempt of Congress. The public was ready and backed that. Then, when the so-called smoking gun tape went public, proving Nixon's direct involvement on August 5th, it was over. 4 days later, on August 9th, 1974, he resigned. 25 members of his administration were convicted of crimes. I was a young street-fighting radical lefty, thoroughly pissed off that he hadn't been impeached from the very beginning of his inauguration. That was before feminism got me out of New York City, and I began to travel and listen to women in particular, but the rest of the country as a whole, and even more importantly, the rest of the world. I'd lived in a radical bubble in Manhattan's Lower East Side, thinking, for example, that racism and sexism were practiced only by white men. It became an increasingly complex world in which to make my revolution. So it's not age, but history, that these days makes me believe that my own congressman, Representative Jerry Nadler of New York, who chairs the House Judiciary Committee, is doing precisely what he should be doing. So is Pelosi, our "don't mess with me, boys," Speaker of the House. The Bill Clinton process of impeachment moved too fast, and wow, did it backfire. Jerry Nadler has already begun impeachment hearings, called by any other name, so that the Trumpists aren't supplied with further ammunition for their grievance whining, and also so that the American public might actually pay attention to such hearings. I know that the damage Trump does in power every single minute of every day is real, and that it can seem maddening to let the political education process take its necessary time. But when you compare the time taken so far with how long it took for Nixon to be booted out of office, and remember, he had been elected in an unequivocal landslide engineered by no foreign power less than 2 years earlier, well, than the Trump good riddance has been moving by comparison at lightning speed. Somehow, though, the narrative gets framed that those who are for immediately starting impeachment charges, even though they'll certainly lose in the current Senate, which will certainly not abandon Trump until senators begin hearing from their constituents, who will certainly not change until they begin to fully grasp details that news junkies already know by heart, well, somehow that narrative gets framed as people who say, wait a week or two for televised hearings and public awakening. Those people are too moderate and cowardly. Well, those who are truly radicals want to move him out right this minute, even though they admit the Senate won't. For me, the narrative frames differently. I thought, I still do think, that we're fighting to preserve at least the idea of this as a democratic republic, while Trump and his followers seem quite ready for authoritarian rule. All I am saying is give folks a chance. Our schools educate them poorly. Our press tries, of late anyway, and some of them, so many, just don't care. So televised hearings are the daily political soap operas that seem to do the trick. It's live television, for one thing. It's water cooler conversation. It's barbershop talk. It's factory break conversation and playground conversation. I think it's radical to trust the people. And then, to lead, to strike, hard. A surreal situation requires a fluid, even surreal, response. And last, our untranslatable word for this week, among words in another language that in English require a sentence or more, this week's is from the Japanese. The word is yugen, in Western alphabet, Y-U-G-E-N. It's the name of a mood in which one feels the universe as a whole possesses an elusive, mysterious beauty. Sunrise on an ocean, moonlight, snow on distant mountains, starlings flocking and dipping in an evening sky, these all feed such a sensibility, however impermanent. The Japanese are especially good at naming impermanent ecstasy, which is the joyful surreal. It's time for another break, and then I'll be back with a conversation. This week, my guest is a voice for the Chicana community, Mexican Americans, Latinx community, the lesbian community, the feminist community, women in general. You know, for me, she is simply a major American literary voice. That's coming right up. The Women's Media Center, founded in 2005 by Jane Fonda, Gloria Steinem, and myself, is a progressive, nonpartisan, nonprofit organization working to make women visible and powerful in media. You can learn more about the WMC at womensmediacenter.com.
You're listening to Women's Media Center Live with Robin Morgan.
And we're back again, this time with the conversation. The conversation today is with my guest, Cherie Moraga, who is an internationally recognized poet, playwright, essayist, memoirist, and activist. This bridge called My Back, writings by radical women of color, which she conceived and co-edited with Gloria Anzaldúa, the avant-garde feminist anthology by women of color, changed the tenor and politics of the women's movement. As a political and literary essayist, she has published several collections, including A Chicana Codex of Changing Consciousness and Waiting in the Wings, Portrait of a Queer Motherhood. She is the recipient of the Rockefeller Fellowship for Literature, the American Studies Association Lifetime Achievement Award, and the Lambda Foundation's Pioneer Award, among many other honors. As a playwright, she's received 2 Fund for New American Plays Awards, as well as a Dramalogue and Critics Circle Award and the Penn West Award. She's published 3 volumes of her plays and recently premiered and directed her newest work, The Mathematics of Love, at Brava Theater Center in San Francisco. For over 20 years, she served as an artist in residence in the Department of Theater and Performance Studies at Stanford and mentored a whole generation of now published writers and professional playwrights. In 2017, she began her tenure as a professor in the Department of English at the University of California, Santa Barbara, where, with her artistic partner, Celia Herrera Rodriguez, she has instituted Las Maestras Center for Chicana Indigenous Thought and Art Practiced. She is also an activist politically and a founding member of La Red Chicana Indígena, an advocacy network of Chicanas working in education, the arts, spiritual practice, and indigenous women's rights. And she has just completed and newly out a new literary memoir entitled Native Country of the Heart. And we're going to talk about that and everything else we can today. Cherie, welcome. Welcome to the program.
No, it's great to be here. Thank you.
I am so glad to have you here. I have been for, 40 years? 30 years. You're younger than I am. Such a fan. I mean, this bridge called my back, which you gave birth to together with Gloria Anzaldúa and then Kitchen Table Women of Press, Women of Color Press, which you and Gloria and Barbara gave birth to, Barbara Smith, changed my life as it did the lives of countless other women. And starting from that point on, I have followed your work, and it's absolutely major work in literature of any language, and you write in both, which is very humbling to me. So it's a joy to have you here.
No, thanks. It's great to be so well received. I appreciate you saying that. That means a lot to me.
I want to talk about what it's like to be an activist and a writer and the interesting balancing act that is, but I want to start with this new book, which is a memoir, and it is an absolute blessed gift to anybody who reads. It's called Native Country of the Heart. It is your memoir, and it is both heartbreaking and heartmending. I don't know what else to call it. Talk about Native Country of the Heart.
Well, I think for you to say it's heartbreaking and heartmending is probably the best kind of summation, I think, of the whole book. I appreciate those words you put around it. I would say it's basically a portrait of a relationship. It's my mother and my relationship with each other, and it's really a daughter's telling of her mother's story, and it's not really a biography of her as much as sort of, I think, a portrait. I think it's a portrait of both geography or of California, being Mexicans in California, Mexican-Americans in California, and also a portrait of her desire, I think. And it started for me when she began to have dementia, and that then we realized was diagnosed as Alzheimer's. And it had occurred to me that I had been hearing a lot of stories about Alzheimer's, but never really from the perspective of women of color, in particular, you know, a Latina, a Mexican woman. And so I began to just, you know, I thought maybe this was going to be the most horrible thing in the world because my mother, was the family cuentista. She was the family storyteller. Everything when her generation goes, you know, like I just feared we all go, like there's a way in which they had a sense about who they were as Mexicans in the United States. So I'm not sure all of us quite got the same message, you know, given assimilation and all of that. And so there's a way that her private amnesia really kind of took me to looking at also questions of cultural amnesia in the United States, you know, for people of color, in particular Chicanos, you know. So it's a small, it was like a very intimate, it's a very intimate story that also had these repercussions to me that were also about, you know, the whole issue of, you know, how we remain being ourselves and keeping our own cultural memory when there's such thrust in the United States to forget.
Yes. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, it's the cultural memory. It's as if she was the repository of the family cultural memory. And if she goes, it fragments. And I, one of the ways I thought of this as I was reading it is it's a love story. It's a passionate love story between you and your mother, which wakened all my wounds and they ran fresh blood of me and my mother. I mean, mothers and daughters. And then there is the layer of assimilation that goes on, but it's assimilation of patriarchy as well as of ethnicity.
Absolutely.
Because
yes.
When you finally come out to your mother, oh my God, oh my God. I mean, that is among the most memorable sets of pages that has been put down on paper. And we've all had our different versions of this, but you're a writer, a real writer. I mean, a real writer. And so the writing itself, which I might point out to myself, as I often do, is in a second tongue. I mean, it's really disgusting, Cherie, that you write this well in two languages, and I'm doing my damned best in one. It the envy is so great, it penetrates my sisterhood. unfair. But it is so unashamedly beautiful and unashamedly womanly in the deepest. I don't know. I don't even know what I mean by womanly, and I do. Those passages where you're fighting with each other are just, you know, you should read with something, drinking something strong. if you
preferably tequila, I don't know.
Yeah, something. I'm telling you, sometimes I had to put down the book and walk across the room and breathe deeply because it brought so much back in a very different context, but in some ways an identical one. And you always go back and forth, macro and micro, so that the infinite tenderness and rage that is at the and confusion and speaking across one another and sometimes actually to one another in that electric moment, all of that individual intimacy resonates back and forth in your writing with what is happening in the culture at whole. And that is both dizzying and exhilarating, even when it's frightening. Am I making any sense, or do I sound like a blubbering fan?
To me, it just is, it's very affirming. I feel like you really, I mean, those are very conscious, you know, choices for me in the writing. And so I don't know, it gratifies me to hear that, you know, someone gets it, you know, it's like, this is good. I mean, that you're a writer, you can see that too, you know. I try, in a way, I've never, ever been able, you know, honestly, to separate, you know, the strongest tenets I learned from, you know, the women's movement in the 70s was the person was political.
Yeah.
And it can sound so generic, but in fact, I do feel like most of my writing has always done that. It's like, I always feel like in Bridge, when we talked about theory in the flesh, I mean, there is, it to me, unless, you know, you can know something in your head, but until your heart understands it through practice, you know, it's not really knowledge yet, you know?
Right.
So thank you for that. I mean, I think that very much is just, it's the fiber of the book for me that I feel like by talking about I or we, my mother and I, that there is a much larger we in it. You know?
Oh yeah. I've dreamt of her. I mean, when I was reading, I dreamt of her, and she got mixed up with my mother in my dream, and I thought,
am I,
my subconscious is assimilating itself into something. I don't know what's going on, but I'm grateful. I'm grateful for it.
You
write at one point, there's so many wonderful individual sentences that are just so, to a writer, are like, oh, with death as exhibitionist. I saw myself stripped of the illusion of my separateness from the suffering of others. Oh, hell. I mean, Cherie, it's also a story of family at the level of exquisite love, hate, cruelty, pettiness, alienation, jealousy. And you recognize yourself or those you know in every page, I think. I mean, I think this should be forced reading for everybody in the United States and the world. Was it very hard to write or shockingly easy?
No, it was very hard.
I thought so, yeah.
I mean, you know, this is we're talking a lot of years and a lot of years of revision, too. You know,
yeah.
I think that sometimes the hardest part is actually to get out of your way, you know. Like in the writing, that if there's too much of our own, it's almost like you have to go through grief, or you have to go through anger, or you have to go through all of those to really find kind of the deeper place that because all that other stuff is flatter than the heart of it. And usually the heart of it, you end up in a certain place, I would like to believe, of compassion. For yourself, for the people that hurt you, for, you know, all of it on a certain level. And I don't think that, I for me, in terms of the writing process, I have to go through a lot of ugly, you know, to find the beauty in pain, you know. You have to go through a lot of ugly, you know.
Yeah.
So it's, you're there, you know, you understand. So, yeah, it's really hard, very, very hard. And, you know, I feel like I had good support along the way, you know, to make this happen, so.
Andrea used to say, Dworkin, she used to, God that does not exist should rest her soul. She used to say, well, as writers, we really spend our lives going down into the mines looking for that glint of silver or what might be a shard of a precious jewel or something. But this is the kind of job that when you come back up, you're left with emotional black lung disease. It was her classic gallows humor of Andrea, but there's something to it. Yeah.
You're right.
You have, you're a playwright. You're a teacher. You're all these many things, and you're an activist. I could answer this from my side by simply saying with difficulty, but I'll ask you because maybe you got a better answer. How do you handle all this? How do you balance all this? How do you handle it?
Well, I think we always wonder that, right, in our lives. I mean, I just feel like one thing I can say is that and for better or for worse about this, you know, I feel like I was really raised to be a worker.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's all I can tell you from the beginning, you know.
Yep.
You know, I'm first generation. My sister and brother and I are the first to go to college. And what I really learned how to do when I was a kid was work, you know, house clean, fix things, organize.
Right.
And in the midst of a lot of, you know, sometimes a lot of chaos, I was always organized, you know, I was trying to put things together, you know.
The caregiver.
And I feel like there's a part of that even, for example, even when I'm, the sort of the rigor in which, because always we have to make a living, so I've always had to make a living, so that was never an issue, and I would do that, and I was very fortunate that I fell in love with teaching, and I could do that, but I've also done all those other jobs, but the point of it is that the writing part, or the discipline of the writing, I just would be, it for me, and many times I feel like, you know, and the people close to me have often said that I'm just ruthless, you know, because it's like I felt like no matter what I did, you know, if I was, you know, I do get involved very much, you know, in terms of particularly cultural activism and then the teaching and then the students and then all this stuff and the family and, you know, I raise children, I have my own son, all this stuff, but the writing was always, I felt like I wasn't, if I couldn't get to that, there was something wrong with my life, you know?
That's right.
And I think you just do it.
Do you set schedules? This is a selfish question here. Because I am always saying that. I'm always telling you, if a younger person says, how do I find time? And I say, you don't find time, you make time.
Yeah, you make it.
But I don't always make it myself.
Yeah.
The demands of the various movements and sustaining life. Are very immediate, and so to
right.
and also people think that you just shift gears. You know, you come back from a speech and you sit down and you'll
forget it.
Dash off a poem or a chapter. The transitions are really hard. So,
yes.
How do you set specific hours or months or days? Any tips?
Well, I think that, too, when you're talking about young writers, I agree with you. I mean, I always say to young writers, I say, I don't care. You know, you get your – I used to do this when I was very young, in my 20s, that I would open – in those days you really had, you know, handwriting, calendars, right?
Right.
And so I'd put in the calendar – I would put literally write in the calendar work. I would never say write.
Yes.
I would say work. And so if someone looked at my calendar, they would know that Monday, Wednesday, Friday, and Sunday, whatever it was, from 9 to 1, I was working.
Right.
And then I'd call, and I'd tell myself, someone calls me, can you do X, Y, Z? And I'd say, I'm working.
Mm-hmm.
So they think I had a job.
They respected, which was important.
Yes. If you said you were writing, then you could get out of it. You
yes.
know, yes. So I think we have these different strategies as we go along. Certainly what I've noticed is that if I'm in the middle, and you talked about playwriting, for example, if I'm in the middle of doing a play, that energy can have me, kind of teaching in a way that I'm not giving it my full interest and intention, but I'm like actually every minute coming back to that writing,
yes.
to that writing. Maybe that lasts 2 weeks, maybe it lasts 3 weeks, maybe it lasts a couple months. But then I think the harder question is, how do you generate when you're not in the midst of it, you know? So
yes,
it's different strategies
yes.
depending on the role. If you're on
oh.
a role, I can work, you know?
Yeah, no, you're right. That's very
yeah.
familiar because, in other words, with me, it would be a novel. If it's a protracted work, then I enter into it willy-nilly.
Yes.
I dream
yes.
it. I make notes in the middle of the night that I didn't remember that I made, but they're useful, and when I wake up and read them. And so I walk through,
yeah.
I
yeah,
walk
yeah.
through my days almost in a daydream. The real part of me is writing the novel. And
right.
with any
yes.
or a long
Good.
Poem, a book length poem. I mean, if it's a
yeah.
protracted work, where it gets harder is when I'm, actually writing nonfiction short poems. Political prose is a different matter,
mm-hmm.
and I can do that back and forth. But what's yeah. harder is with poetry, where it is not a prolonged work, but the poor little poem keeps getting shunted aside, and then it raises its head, you know, and it says, I'm still here, and you think, oh, yeah, I'll get back
yeah.
to you. Oh, yeah. God, it's like a loyal dog that keeps coming back, even though you're kicking it. So
yeah.
that's.
I think it's the generative part that's sometimes very difficult to make time for it, you
yeah.
know, where you really say, no, I'm going to set aside these many months. Like, and I think I try to do that sometimes when I know I actually am cleared for a couple months that my priority is just to write. It's easier now doing that because my kids are grown.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah.
But it's always, I don't think the advice is like,
it doesn't
you do
work.
It,
yeah,
you do the best you can. You
yes,
know?
You
That's
do.
Kinda it.
You know, it's the
yeah.
interruptions as I grow older also, and my short-term memory begins to have its own hallucinations and intentions.
Yes.
It begins to be harder to, you know, when you're interrupted. And of course, life is one great set of interruptions.
Exactly. Yeah.
So if I'm revising, it's easier for me to go back
yes.
to it. But if I'm trying to just sit and let something germinate, oh God, and the phone rings, I'm screwed.
Yeah.
No,
I feel that way too. It's just like too, I do tell people, like in terms of teaching, when I teach creative writing, I was, you know, and you're on something, I know this for myself, I have to have several days in a row because when you're trying to generate something and it just starts to surface, you have to be able to go the very next day right back to that.
Yes,
spot.
Yes, yes.
Yeah, yeah, and keep a roll going. And it's very hard.
That's right.
Nothing, but that's what it requires.
Nothing is more frustrating than to feel that it was just, it was cut off and you can't get back to it. I mean, it doesn't always turn willingly. Oh, it's very comforting, yes, to know that,
You're not alone.
Do you have, of course you don't, do you have a favorite among your different many forms of writing? Each is rewarding in its own way.
I think that when you're doing it, it requires different things. And so I think I like what theater and, writing plays. I like what it's done for the rest of my writing. I think that in a way that I never had anticipated, because I kind of fell into playwright. I wasn't trained as a playwright, but I was very lucky early on to. I worked with Maria Irene Fornes. Sorry, let me turn this off. I worked with Maria Irene Fornes. People call her Irene Fornes, who's just she passed last year, but amazing mentorship with her. And what I realized in that is that she allowed me, and another teacher wouldn't have done this, but she allowed me to be a poet, on stage,
Yes.
But the structure of playwriting is it's very challenging, because in 2 hours, you got to make a story happen.
Right.
So I learned also about dramatic tension. I mean, all these kinds of things I just learned through practice. And I think it's actually impacted, like even this novel, I mean, even this memoir, how to write a true story, but still with dramatic tension, holding back certain things,
right?
Playing with different structures and all that. For me, playwriting has been probably the most rewarding to me in terms of what it teaches me about other genres, even an essay.
Fascinating.
And that essay has characterization, all of that.
Yes.
So and also characters, you see, don't have to have all the answers. Well, this from novel writing, characters can be, contradictory and, no footnotes. And,
right. Yeah, no, they're damn right. That's very, very satisfying. Oh, God.
Yes.
When you go to when you go to fiction out of nonfiction prose, it is just, no footnotes. Yes. Hallelujah.
Yeah. It's fun. And that's what, playwriting is. Playwriting is fiction for me, is what I do.
Yes, right. Exactly.
Yeah,
exactly.
Yeah.
Oh, I could talk for hours, and I know that you've got to do other interviews and you're on the book tour. This book, listen, listeners, if you have read Cherie Moraga before, this is the triumph of everything you've read before. Mm-hmm. If you have never read her before, it's damn well time you started, and you better start right here, because once you put this book down and you have to go buy more tissues because you've been through three boxes already, and laugh, not only cry, laugh, then you'll read on in all the rest of her work, which is brilliant. I'm so grateful to you for just being Cherie Moraga, and all that that's cost you, and all that that's rewarded you, and all that you are to us. And by us, I mean not only specifically your own community, the lesbian community, the Chicana community, but everybody who loves beautiful writing and wise perception and the guts to fight injustice. And I'm very grateful I got to live on the planet at the same time as you, Moraga. I really am.
Well, thank you, Robin. That's really, I hold that in my heart. I really, really appreciate your true words to me. I really, it's a long time. It's really beautiful to get it. This time in our lives together. So thank you for that.
Yeah, we'll make up for lost time.
That sounds good.
And thanks for being with us, and have the rest of a great book tour.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
It's time for our last break, and then I'll return directly with some fighting words.
For the smartest talk about news, politics, sex, books, religion, race, and more, it's Women's Media Center Live with Robin Morgan. Audacious, witty, provocative, informative, and fun. It's Women's Media Center Live with Robin Morgan. Talk radio with a brain.
Welcome back to Some Fighting Words. If you're a regular listener, you know that this past month, which is Poetry Month, this April, I decided to take a break from the usual political prose that constitutes this section of the program, Fighting Words, and instead read a poem of mine. And I chose poems going way back into the 70s and on up ever since. And the poems, of course, are political in their own way. There's nothing that's not political. But I chose poems particularly with a theme, the theme of making art, specifically poems, but in one case, visual art. And today, which is the last of the mini poetry readings during the last week of April, I decided to read a poem bringing us right into the present, from Dark Matter, which is my new book of poems that just came out last year. It's called Reading the Bones, and it's a fairly dark poem. But then again, it really isn't. The darkness comes from the subject matter from which one makes art. But the making of it, at least for me, hallows the subject matter and brings it, in all senses of the word, enlightenment. In any event, the poem is called Reading the Bones from Dark Matter, and here it is. I glimpse lines crazing my face in the window glass, crane's bones emerging. My eyes are growing larger. Soon they will perch on stalks and swivel, crustacean. The better to see how others do it, this last chance at living. I watch them, agnostics entangled by their roots, Jews reclaimed by feminist satyrs, African Americans by Sunday church. The atheists study history, showing a sudden personal interest in the past as they prepare to enter it. As for the ones who've left already, they and we, the dead and living, share mutual disbelief. The message is we're too fatigued to change the myths of ourselves at this stage, preferring to die, unmake the world in the familiar. Understandable. Yet I persist in lusting to be seamless with the universe while still aware of it. So I suspect a future darkly bright, kaleidoscopic as symmetries glittering beneath eyelids, rubbed dry of tears. Time intimate as an embalmer. Deep time. A passion there so vast it flows inseparable from indifference, unlike any passions I have known. Not those of youth, when I longed to read the bones, thinking I knew the cost of such literacy. Not zeal to save the world, not desire in a lover with the heat-seeking lips of a blood python. No, this fire burns as ice, melts only for metaphors that puzzle into patterns not of meaning, but of beauty, not of beauty, but of till that moment, the unthinkable. For instance, retreating from Russia's winter, Napoleon saw they had stuffed the broken windows of hospitals with their frozen dead, feet, limbs, heads, to fit the apertures. Decades ago, in Rome's Capuchin catacombs, I took notes to play with in my private funeral games, then dared not use them until now. Now they remind me that such crypts are not to be confused with Phnom Penh's neat pyramids of skulls, the tidy skeleton stacked in Vukovar, remains beyond wounded at Wounded Knee, or Kigali's ossuary pits. These catacombs are galleries for works of art. The medium is human bone, room after small room, layered in the thousands, rosettes of sacrum framed by vertebra, jawbone maxillae as vaulted triangles, garlands woven of ribs and carpals, arches of crossed femurs, roses tiled with shoulder scapula and kneecap patella. No inch of cornice, wall, or ceiling is left unsculled. Smiles of these fragmented, nameless dead form wallpaper against which featured exhibits are displayed, the eight-pointed star of foot phalanges, the winged skull flanked by a sacrum, a boss of pelvises, an hourglass, metatarsal flowers, tibia stars, the full palate is used, all 206 bones of the human body. And in the foreground, the named dead lie whole and mummified on cushions plumped with bone. Capuchin monks full-robed, a doctor who died ministering to victims of the plague, elaborately shrouded nieces of a pope, and postured dancing, naked, the skeletons of three small children. Breath catches suddenly. The air is dusty. Another tourist, a priest, claims this artistry by friars done in waves across centuries was to celebrate the resurrection. Considering their chosen medium, I doubt that motive, although John Donne did wrap himself in a winding sheet while burning candles in the human skull he kept on his desk as he wrote the devotions called the Holy Sonnets. His own devotion, however, he reserved for poetry. I too have a skull above my desk, a photograph of the shape formed by rose petals, delicate, dissonant. Each day I pay respect to death. Respect was simpler, I admit, when death was an abstraction. Now friends in the ICU need visits and entrust me with defending their DNR directives. So here's another lament for the makers. Muriel, Dorothy, Florica, Simone, Eve, Polly, June, Carolyn, Audrey, Bella, Barbara, Andrea, Wilma, Adrienne, Grace, Gerda, Mary, Leslie, Corinne, Kate. Naming my dead, the women who made mischief, poems, laws, pies, incremental seismic change. All the arguments, the laughter, the suffering, silenced now. Whoever's next, I'm done with eulogies. Nevertheless, I understand more deeply than I would prefer why those obsessive friars, assured by the reliable supply of their materials, built that world. Don't you and I construct our days, using what we drag back from nights spent foraging our losses? What other materials does anyone ever really have? The catacombs are everywhere. Look, do you see? A rose, a star. The hourglass fills, drains. Ignore the tourists. Look away from the window. Here, wear the garland, it's meant for you. So are these fragments, assembled with passion, indifference, reliable pain. Look, do you see? A poem, layer on layer, words puzzled together, bones from the catacomb of a brain. Those are my fighting words. Add yours on Twitter. And be sure to tag us at WMC Live and use the hashtag #FightingWords. that's our show for today. You can follow me on Twitter at The Robin Morgan and on Facebook at facebook.com/TheRobinMorgan. Check out my blog at robinmorgan.net and find my latest book, Dark Matter, wherever books are sold. Opinions expressed on this program do not necessarily represent the Women's Media Center. Here's the family for our show. Executive producer as well as founding and sustaining sponsor, Regina K. Scully. WMC president and co-executive producer of this program, Julie Burton. I'm Robin Morgan, your producer and host. Thank you for being with us. Join us again next time on Women's Media Center Live.